Welcome to Podcast 9 on the topic of populism in Latin America. I'm Dr. Benjamin Bryce. This is History 281, Republican Latin America at the University of Northern British Columbia. Today I'm going to talk about four points. First, populism in Latin America broadly defined, and then I'm going to zoom in on two national case studies. The first, populism during the Mexican Revolution, and the second, populism in Argentina in the mid-20th century. And then my final point, number four, is on the legacies of populism and the meaning of populism in these two national contexts. So to my first point on populism in Latin America broadly defined, populism is different in each country and it's different over time. But there are a few central features that can help us understand it and define it. It has been a central political concept political culture in shaping 20th century Latin American politics. Historian Michael Conniff describes populism as, and I quote, or says that populists did, and I quote, raised more campaign money, got more voters to the polls, and held followers' allegiances far better than traditional politics and politicians. Populism in the mid-20th century in Latin America had a few key features, and thinking about today's current uses, you can reflect on how this does or does not also apply. So first, populism is defined by having a charismatic, nationalistic leader. A populist leader has the support of the working classes and often has a pro-labor image. A populist promises material improvements for the poor, and masses of new voters are drawn into a populist movement. People who hadn't been voting before, as at least in the case of early and mid-20th century Latin America in contexts of less democratic societies, working class people in particular, marginalized voices in particular, are drawn into politics for the first time, and they throw their support behind a leader promising material improvements for them. Now, the ideology and programs of populist leaders rarely fit existing doctrinal schemes. So populists drew from socialism, communism, democratic capitalism, fascism, and corporatism. And in fact, why you can perhaps see fascist tendencies or socialist tendencies in a populist is because that populist is borrowing both from fascism and from socialism and from democratic capitalism. So instead, because they do not fit into these simple molds of socialism or corporatism or communism or democratic capitalism, populism is instead often defined by the name of the leader. So Peronismo is the populism as it took form in mid-20th century Argentina under the leadership of Juan Perón. Cardenismo in 1930s Mexico under the leadership of Lázaro Cárdenas. And Getulismo in Brazil in the mid-20th century under the leadership of Getulio Vargas. So in the 1930s and 1940s, and this specific form of populism that we're talking about and not its most modern iterations, was an economic experiment. Like Keynesianism or neoliberalism, and sometimes it was successful and sometimes it was not. It was about changing the relationship between capital and work, about benefits, the role of the state. And in this sense, it's an experimental economic project, very much in vogue in the 1930s and 1940s, seeking new solutions to things that were clearly a problem. Now, the term is being used a lot right now in the media, and in particular regarding Donald Trump, Brexit, but also things like Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. In the case of very myopic, short-sighted journalists, they talk about the rise of populism in Brazil under Bolsonaro, but in fact, Brazil has a very long history of populism, and it's only the rise of someone who has sort of North Atlantic tendencies in his populism that makes the northern journalists talk about a new Brazilian populism. So a few things to take away from today in considering how often the term is now being used in the media. Populism is much older than the recent political developments, and it's much more complex. If you try to apply what you know about Donald Trump to understand mid-20th century populists in Latin America, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. So the right-wing, big business, anti-environment, xenophobic, and sexist features of current populists is not the definition of populism. The other things they're doing is what makes them populist, and being sexist or destroying the environment or passing new legislation about immigration itself is not necessarily a populist act, or it's only populist because the definition of populism is appealing to the masses to sort of gain political support. And I'm going to get to that in a second. So the key thing about populism is about appealing to the majority at the expense of everybody else who does not support that politician. So rather than seeking consensus, which has been a general feature of liberal democracies, populists do not seek consensus, they seek the majority. And to win that majority, they often greatly anger the minority. So populism, again, in mid-20th century Latin America, creates an interventionist state with the goal of maintaining political power. So a populist in mid-20th century Latin America, this might surprise you based on current definitions of populism, raised the general standard of living for the working class or for the majority of people in a society. It created government jobs. It financed neighborhood improvements. It authorized easy loans. It subsidized food staples. It set low fares on public transit. It decreed better employment benefits for workers in particular. And it stoked economic growth with deficit spending. That's what makes this an economic experiment, and that's what makes this version of populism quite different from how it's being used today. What unites them is this not seeking consensus, concentrating power in a charismatic leadership figure, things like that. But the definition of populism is much broader. So populists won elections and stood for re-election. They were democratic in mid-20th century Latin America. They sought to reach and win over growing number of voters. They broadened the franchise. They sought new supporters. They brought people into democracy, people who had in previous decades been marginalized from the democratic system. They assured impartial procedures. So they were in fact very pro-democracy and not into election tampering. They emerged out of less democratic contexts and in many cases were then overthrown by dictatorship. So it's the populist moment that is the democratic moment, and the decades before and the decades after populists in mid-20th century Latin America are the non-democratic moments. Yet a populist also centered power in himself. They are very democratic, but also authoritarian at the same time. And in someone opposing this a specific populist can emphasize the authoritarian tendencies of a populist to emphasize how he was not democratic. But there are several features about a populist system that is very democratic at the same time as being authoritarian. So to give you a couple of examples of mid-20th century Latin American populism and how that it was very democratic and brought more people into the political system. In Argentina, before Juan Perón comes to power, say in the 1937 election, 2 million people voted. In the first election where Perón came to power, 2.9 million people voted. So this is just sort of a normal demographic population increase in the country. In 1951, 7.6 million people voted. So it goes from 2.9 million people to 7.6 million people in a five-year period. A major part of this is and a key feature of his populist project, he gave, or in response to a long history of demands, women gained the right to vote in Argentine elections. So that instantly doubled the voting base. But the increase from 2.9 to 7.6 million is even greater than the increase in just doubling the voter base by adding women in addition to men as possible voters. Similar things happened in Mexico, although less pronounced. There was still actually far less political participation. But in the election that Lázaro Cárdenas, so in 1920, in the aftermath of the end of the violence of the Mexican Revolution, 1.2 million people voted, or even 10 years before to think of an undemocratic system. In 1910, in the last election before the Mexican Revolution, 500,000 people voted. It more than doubles after the Mexican Revolution. In 1934, it's doubled again to 2.3 million people. And in 1940, it's 2.6 million people. So there's growing voter participation in these democracies. In Brazil, it's very pronounced, like in Argentina. So 1930, when Vargas starts and in the beginning of his power, only 1.9 million people are voting. And in 1945, at the end of Vargas's period of power, 6.2 million people are voting. And in 1951, just another 6 years later, 9.1 million people are voting. So there's a massive expansion of democratic participation in these societies. The mobilization of the working class and previously marginalized people is a key feature of mid-20th century Latin American populism. In so doing, it actually destabilizes the previous balance of power in which elites had all the power and the vast majority of people had very little power and very little representation. So in being democratic, it leads to, there's an often an undemocratic backlash. The elites seek the support from the military and it leads to coups as a response to these populist systems. So, but the populist system itself is one, that's a key feature. It's angering people who had power before. And the outcome of it is then non-democratic, but the populist movement itself was democratic. So to my first case study and point number two, populism in the Mexican Revolution. So Mexico from 1934 to 1940 is led by Lázaro Cárdenas, the president of Mexico, and he's a classic example of a populist. Cárdenas participated in the Mexican Revolution. He was quite young. In 1910, he was running a newspaper at the age of 16. He was supporting one of the opponents to Díaz, Francisco Madero. Starting in 1913, he fought with one of the revolutionary leaders of the Mexican Revolution, a very famous and one of the more revolutionary revolutionaries, Emiliano Zapata in the south. And he was then later, he later fought with and supported someone who then came to be president of Mexico in the 1920s, Plutarco Elias Calles. Now, when Cárdenas stands for the presidency in 1934, he has the support of this former, now former president Calles. And one of the reasons that Calles is supporting Cárdenas in 1934, in the 1934 election, is because he thought he could control them. Calles had been the president from 1924 to 28, but then influenced behind the scenes all subsequent presidents from 1928 to 1934. And in having Cárdenas as a candidate in 1934, Calles assumes that he can carry on his behind the scenes control of the country or control of national politics, but while not being president himself. So in the case of Cárdenas and thinking of this context that there's this actual powerful figure in Calles controlling national politics and Cárdenas is in many ways going to be a puppet to that Calles, Cárdenas uses populist policies to gain power, first against Calles and then against other politicians. So by appealing to democracy and to the masses and to rural peoples, he's gaining political support that he can use to assert his own power vis-a-vis other politicians. So a couple of features of Cárdenas, which really makes him a populist, is that in the 1934 election, he campaigned far more vigorously than any politician had ever done so before in Mexico. He used that campaign to build a mass political following, which is, again, another feature of populism. He traveled 16,000 miles, which in 1934 is a big deal. He visited all the states of Mexico when running for president, something, again, in 1934 that wasn't the case. He held meetings in town squares that lasted for hours. He had all this contact with the regular people and showed a willingness to interact with a groups of people who up until then had not been involved in national politics. And that was something that proved very effective for gaining political support from the people, not from other elites. He campaigned on land reform, which was a key feature of the Mexican Revolution, but something that not had been implemented. So it comes from the 1917 Constitution, and then 17 years later has not been implemented very much, and it becomes a campaign issue that Cárdenas uses and mobilizes and has already the constitutional framework in place to be able to implement it after the fact. He also sought the support of agrarian and workers' unions, so seeking the support of groups that could be politically important or politically powerful, but up until then had not been the object of interest of national politicians. Once in office, he embraced the goals of the 1917 Constitution of land reform, labor rights, and education. So in his presidency, he distributed 50 million acres of land to 800,000 peasant families. That's more land redistribution than all of his predecessors combined, despite the fact that it was a goal of the 1917 Constitution. He also gave peasants rifles to protect that land, so as a way to sort of ensure that the government reforms would be effective. He remodeled and strengthened the governing party, and it's through these acts that the same political party ruled Mexico from the 1930s up until the year 2000. He was enormously popular. Another key feature of Cardenismo, and which is one of the lasting outcomes of the Mexican Revolution, is his investment in education. So during his presidency, 3,000 new schools are built, 100,000 new teachers are employed, and enrollment rises fairly significantly by about 25% from 1.7 million children to 2.2 million children. And while the 25% increase in enrollment is significant, it's also improving the educational system for those who are already in the system. So hiring 100,000 new teachers and building 3,000 new schools is perhaps has perhaps a more lasting legacy even than increasing overall enrollment, because it's laid the groundwork for future growth after his presidency. To my third point about populism in Argentina. So the populist example and the populist moment of Argentina is under the leadership and the presidency of Juan Domingo Perón and his political movement called Peronismo. Perón was the part of the military government of Argentina between 1943 and 1946. In that military dictatorship, he was the vice president and the minister of war, which is the ministry of in 21st century speak, the ministry of defense, but in the 19th and early 20th centuries, they were the ministries of war. And he gained control over a fairly unimportant part of governance as well during this dictatorship, and he became the leader of the National Department of Labor. It wasn't even a ministry, but it was this Department of Labor. And it was through labor that Perón's political power grew during the dictatorship, and then he emerges out of a dictatorship as the president. So during the dictatorship, he's offering state support to unions in labor negotiations. And in 1944, so during the dictatorship before he's president, 228 contracts are signed just in the city of Buenos Aires, and contracts are then inserting the role of the government in labor relations in a way that had not existed before then. Between 1943 and 1945, real wages for unskilled laborers rose 17%, and they also rose for skilled workers by 10%. He assigned labor leaders to important political and bureaucratic posts during this time period, and so it's seeking the support of labor and giving things to labor and giving things to workers that made him increasingly popular, and that leads to his rise to power. Perón also repressed uncooperative unions. All communists were pushed out of the unions. And a socialist-controlled municipal workers' union was taken over by government agents. There's all these non-democratic or non-labor things that Perón is doing. But for the majority of labor or for the majority of workers, he's making positive changes. But it's under his leadership, and anyone opposed to his leadership is being repressed. Perón's slogan, now once moving to the forefront of running for office, his slogan was economic growth and social justice. This is a reconfiguration of the status quo in which he wants to foster economic growth, which presumably is the goal of every politician, but also foster social justice. So economic aid for marginalized working class. Particularly in the first half of his 10-year rule or 9-year rule in from 1946 to 1955, there's a great deal of economic prosperity. In 1947, for example, real wages increased 25%. So that's taking into account of inflation, workers' quality of living drastically improved. He also enacts a number of government policies with improving pension plans, improving healthcare, paying for vacation resorts for workers, all sorts of things that improve the quality of life for workers. And a major outcome of that is gaining political support from those workers. Particularly foreign observers and anyone opposed to him in Argentina often connected Juan Perón and his policies to fascism. It's in part because of his ruling style, the importance of him as a leadership figure, his charismatic style. It's in part because of the time he spent as a military attaché in Mussolini's Italy and his affinity to or admiration of Mussolini's reforms, so a fascist system. And it's in part because of the timing. Perón comes to power in the immediate aftermath of World War II, and both Argentine and foreign observers are wary of mass movements with charismatic leaders. That said, thinking of the definition of populism, it borrows, as I've already said, borrows from fascism, but by borrowing certain things from fascism and certain things from socialism and certain things from democracy, he's sort of by definition not a fascist, he's by definition a populist, because he's only doing a fraction of his overall program is fascist, and that's something that you could also find in other populists throughout the 20th century. So a couple of examples of the real fascism or things that look fascistic in the Peronist system. Rituals and the cult of the leader become a key part of Peronist politics. So Labor Day, May 1st, the International Labor Day, everywhere outside of Canada, the United States, becomes what scholars have called, it becomes Peronized. So it takes on Peronist features. So it's not a Labor Day, it's a Peronist day. And Peronism and labor during this period are being merged into a single thing. That's sort of something also characteristic of mid-20th century or 1930s European fascism, by merging things that aren't party related, but merging them with the party. October 17th becomes celebrated as a national holiday. This is a key date in Peron's rise to power. So in 1945, he's jailed because of his disagreements with the military government. And then workers and unions mobilize to free Peron. And that's what leads to his rise to power. So Peron's rise to power becomes a national holiday, another thing that an observer or critic could call sort of fascistic. And by about 1948, Labor Day and October 17th become merged and have the same meaning. So they're both pro-labor, pro-Peronist days that are celebrated interchangeably, get celebrated twice a year on May 1st and October 17th. But there are several things about Peronism that are not at all fascist. So Peron drew on labor and the poor and the working class for his political power. Business elites are not in Peron's coalition, or business elites are not part of Peron's political power. Peron also ended a dictatorship in 1946. He was a part of that dictatorship and came himself from the military. But he is very democratic and ends a dictatorship. And then he was removed from power in 1955. By the military. So he's removed by dictatorship. And a key definition of fascism, perhaps far more important than the cult of the leader or, you know, the symbolism of national holidays, is that they are anti-democratic. And Peron is the very opposite of anti-democratic. It's everything around Peronism before and after that is anti-democratic. So to my fourth point on the legacy of populism. Populism led to a structural change in the political system and political culture of many countries in Latin America. The heyday of these populist programs and politicians was between the 1930s and the 1960s. Another legacy, though, is that populists were very polemical. They defined themselves as the saviors of the nation and the opponents and their opponents as the enemies of the people. So you're either with us or you're against us, and it's sort of creating this culture of conflict in politics rather than a culture of consensus. Populists upset class and race hierarchies. They gave political power to peasants and workers in Mexico and to urban workers in Argentina. They fundamentally transformed how societies were organized to the benefit of the vast majority, but to the detriment of those who were benefiting from class and race hierarchies before, which leads to all sorts of backlashes over the next half century from the 1960s onwards. Groups seeking to restore the privilege that they had before populists upset that balance. So to some three pros of populism, and then I have a couple of cons as well. They greatly increased popular participation in politics. They incorporated working class and poor people, and they improved the material conditions of millions of people in their specific Latin American country. Now, the cons is that it destabilized the previous political order, and then it leads to these dictatorships and instability in the time that follows populist rule. They did not seek consensus, and they further complicated how politics worked in mid-20th and late 20th century Latin America. And they concentrated political power in themselves. So while doing all these good things for the vast majority of improving the material conditions for people, they were doing so to get political power for themselves. And it's sort of in self-interest that they were acting. So to conclude, populism transformed many political systems in Latin America in the mid-20th century. I made brief reference to Brazil and had two case studies of Mexico and Argentina. Populism was democratic. Populism drew support from workers and rural groups. and it incorporated and tried to control labor unions. Populists started many social programs and, in general, improved the quality of life for the majority of people in the countries where they were enacting their reforms.